Good day. Today is Sunday, 23rd November 2025. And before I proceed with this program, just again to remind you to tick the like button if you've watched the program and decide that you like the program and want to indicate that fact. And to remind you again that I am actually now in Scotland and I'm making this program from my hotel room. The time I can devote to this program is relatively short, so for that reason, it will be a shorter program than usual. And the lighting conditions in Scotland are not always perfect because this is a northerly country and there's little sunlight, or the hours of sunlight in Scotland are short in winter, but this is the best I can do. So apologies for that also. Let's turn to the issues which I'm going to discuss today, and overwhelmingly again in the short time of this programme, I'm going to focus on the situation in and connected to Ukraine. Now, before I do, it's perhaps worth having a brief recap of what it was that Putin said when he addressed the Russian Security Council 2 days ago. He said that he'd seen the plan, that it had not been formally discussed with him, that the plan as it stands is raw. It is not a complete plan. Detailed discussions need to take place. There needs to be a complex negotiation about its various provisions. In a program I made about 2 days ago, I went through the plan, or at least the publicly disclosed version of the plan, the part of the plan that has been published by Alexei Gonjarenko, the Ukrainian MP, and I pointed out that there were certain provisions there that the Russians would not like and indeed would consider unacceptable, like the provision that the Ukrainian army should be 600,000 men. There's no way that the Russians would ever accept a provision like that. And I also said that there were other aspects of the plan, also provisions relating to use of frozen Russian assets, that the Russians would not be acceptable to the Russians either, and that the provision about military forces deployed in Ukraine, the forbidding of military forces being deployed in Ukraine, being limited to NATO forces, is one that the Russians would again have issues with and would certainly want to clarify with the clarifications spelled out to prevent any deployment of Western forces of any kind to Ukraine. On that point, by the way, already someone in Washington is trying to make trouble. There's an article today in the Washington Post which says that if this agreement is concluded with a provision that Ukraine cannot host any Western troops whatsoever, the United States might try to compensate for that by deploying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. That, of course, is also completely unacceptable to the Russians, and it cuts against all claims and comments that we've seen over the last week or so about the Russian concerns that Ukraine should not be in possession of long-range weapons, weapons that could reach Moscow and St. Petersburg, and apparent American acceptance of this. But nonetheless, despite all of that, despite the flaws in the document that has been released, Putin did say that it was a document that Russia could negotiate upon. However, he made other points which, in my opinion, in all of the commentary, have been overlooked. He made it fairly clear that the preferred way of dealing with this conflict on the Russian side was military, that the Russians would prefer to have no negotiations at all, to be under no pressure to engage in negotiations, rather and instead they would prefer a situation where the Russian army battled its way to Kiev and across Ukraine, because ultimately now the Russian objective, as the Russians have made perfectly clear, as Putin recently made perfectly clear when he described the government in Kiev as a criminal group, the Russian objective now is regime change, and negotiations is not obviously a sure-proof way of achieving regime change. And Putin said that the reason, the primary reason, he didn't say it exactly, but he made it fairly clear that the primary reason why Russia has agreed to negotiate, why it is proceeding and going forward with negotiations, why it's been constantly preferring to have discussions with Donald Trump and all of those things, which we have seen over the last year, is because Russia's friends and allies, China, India, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, other countries, wanted to. Putin emphasized, he used that word to the members of the Security Council, that when he had discussed with Russia's friends and allies the outcome of the discussions between himself and Trump in Anchorage, and had laid out for them what the Americans had proposed and agreed to, which is a modified version of Istanbul Plus, all of Russia's allies supported it. So the allies, China, India, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, all of these countries want to see, if possible, a negotiated settlement. And if that negotiated settlement is not achieved, then it is extremely important for the Russians, not just for economic reasons, but as part of their effort to construct a multipolar global system. It is extremely important for the Russians that if negotiations fail, their friends and allies do not blame them. So it was very interesting comments from Putin. But Putin also said something else. He said that if the negotiations fail, if the Ukrainians and the Europeans reject the plan, that's fine, because Russia's desired outcome continues to be a military victory, and that military victory is now on the horizon. The Russians are winning. They're winning right across the front lines, and in fact, a situation where talks finally and conclusively collapse would suit the Russians better than this complex game of negotiations that we have seen play out over the last year. Putin's comments to the Security Council were extraordinarily interesting. They do require a certain amount of interpretation. But if they are interpreted correctly and properly, in accordance with the normal meaning and usage of words and language, then the meaning becomes entirely clear. Now that brings us to what has happened over the last 24 hours, because there has been a huge row already between the Americans and the Europeans, and that row is getting worse. Now, Dan Driscoll, who appears to have taken over from Kellogg as the United States' peace envoy, though I should say that Kellogg is still in post, formally, he's still giving interviews. He's just given an interview in which he says that the United States needs to avoid a Budapest memorandum and a Minsk 1 and a Minsk 2 scenario, which appears to place the blame for the failure of Minsk 1 and Minsk 2 on the Russians. Of course, the Russians, who have extensively reported Kellogg's words, have pointed out that in reality, it was the Ukrainians that failed to implement Minsk 2. Anyway, Kellogg said all of this in ways that, to my mind, made it absolutely clear his strong disagreement, even with this hodgepodge of a plan that Witkoff and others in Washington have come up with. And his daughter, by the way, has also been active. I read in the British media that she's been going around telling people that the original draft of this agreement, the 28-point plan, was written in Russian. Supposedly, Dmitriev drafted it, Witkoff accepted it. We're getting reports in Bloomberg that Rubio was completely cut out of the discussions and knew nothing about it until almost the last moment, that many people within the US government were stunned that all of this work was being done on this plan right up until the moment when it was announced. And the Europeans, of course, were cut out of all of the discussions completely. Now, you need to be very careful before you believe much of that. Earlier reports spoke of Rubio being heavily involved in the work of this plan. It strikes me that Rubio is back to his usual game of running both with the hare and with the hounds. On the one hand, he is giving every appearance of being the loyal supporter of Trump, of Witkoff, of the entire America First program. He was the first American official after the Trump administration was inaugurated to talk about the United States now being in a new multipolar period and needing to adjust its foreign policies to reflect that. But at the same time, it seems to me that Rubio is also busy telling his old neocon friends that it's fine, he's still one of them. He's not really had any role in this horror that has just been put together, and that he was as surprised by what happened as they are. I accept that this is my interpretation. Rubio doesn't talk to me, but well, I'm an old bureaucratic warrior, as I have said many times, and I'm sure that that is what is going on. So anyway, we're getting lots of muddle and misinformation about the plan itself. And I'm going to say something, which is now it is clear to me at least that some provisions of this plan have indeed been worked over since Witkoff came up with the first draft and obtained Dmitriev's thoughts about it. And there have been some changes which have been introduced by other people. For example, it seems that it is now widely acknowledged that the provision in the plan that Ukraine should have an army of 600,000 men was actually inserted into the plan by Rustem Umerov, the secretary of Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council. I will come back to him very soon. So we could see that the Ukrainians have, at least in part, changed aspects of this plan despite various denials. And here, by the way, I should mention a comment that was made to me, an email that was made to me yesterday by a acquaintance in Moscow. He messaged me and said that, in his opinion, the reason why the 28-point plan that Goncharenko published is so vague in parts, so muddled and confused, so amateur in its totality, is because this is the Ukrainian version of the plan. It incorporates many changes into it, into its initial draft that the Ukrainians inserted into it over the course of the discussions. And it is they who have published it. And some of the changes might not have been agreed with the Russians, obviously, but with the Americans, possibly too. Bear in mind that the Americans themselves so far have not published this plan, and of course neither have the Russians. It could be that the Russians, for example, have a different, earlier version of the plan than the one that was published in the media. Anyway, I'm not going to devote more time and energy to this. It's just to bear in mind that this is still an extremely complex and fluid process. The plan should never have been published in the first place. It was all supposed to be worked on in private. Somebody leaked it. Witkoff has publicly complained about it. He has identified the leaker as K. K is the first letter of Kellogg's surname. I am confident that the leaker was Kellogg, but in fairness, I should say that there are some claims in the American media that the leaker was actually Dmitriev, whose first name, Kirill, also begins with a K. I think that is extremely unlikely myself, but that report is there, and I don't have evidence to refute it myself. Anyway, there it is. So that's what we have at the moment, the situation with the plan. It's still unclear what certain of its provisions are. Putin is prepared to negotiate on its terms, but he does so from a position of immense strength. His armies are advancing on the battlefronts, and he is confident of a military victory, and he would not be sorry if the negotiations collapsed, and the Russians would not be sorry if the negotiations collapsed. They would, however, be prepared to negotiate on the basis of this plan, provided it can satisfy their concerns, because that is what their friends and allies around the world want of them. Now, in the West, it is completely different, because the last 24 hours, especially in Europe, but to some extent in the United States also, but especially in Europe, have been marked by fury and outrage and enormous hostility to this plan. And again, we see the way in which the Europeans function, because despite their anger and their, I think, loathing of Trump, I have no doubt that that is how they feel about him. I read an article today in the British media, which again, and not for the first time, brought up the Russiagate, the original Russiagate, the collusion allegations. And I'm not going to dwell on that or waste time on it, but be aware that those stories are circulating in Europe again, as they have done every time the Americans and the Russians seem to be moving forward with their negotiations. Anyway, despite their anger, despite their dislike of Trump, they still pretend that they welcome Trump's diplomatic initiatives. They don't have the courage to say outright that they reject this plan in its entirety, and that they take great offence to the fact that the president and the Americans are trying to negotiate. The hypocrisy and the duplicity is astounding. And again, it really does beg many questions about the United States and about Trump himself, that they tolerate it. But anyway, the Europeans furious with the plan, and apparently we're told that there was a furious row. I think furious row is probably the right expression. A furious row when EU ambassadors and diplomats met with Dan Driscoll, the US Secretary of the Army, who appears to be fulfilling Kellogg's job, who appears now to be the actual real peace envoy that the Trump administration has in place of Kellogg. And by the way, it does seem that unlike Kellogg, who never at any time either went to Moscow or sought to, Driscoll does intend to go to Moscow eventually. Anyway, it seems that Driscoll met with these European diplomats in Kiev, and there was a row. I read a report that one of the European officials described the meeting as repugnant. And the fact that there was this row and the content of this row really does seem to me extraordinary, because what Driscoll basically said to the Europeans, to the European ambassadors, is, look, Ukraine is losing the war. The Russians are continuing to advance. We've tried everything we can on the sanctions side. It's already doing massive damage to your economies. It could potentially, if persisted in, do further damage to ours. No plan is perfect. No plan is ideal. But if the objective is to save as much of Ukraine as can be saved, in the situation that we are in today, in the circumstances we are in today, this is absolutely the best that is on offer. And the Europeans were furious. They hated every word of it. They apparently said to Driscoll that they were. I won't say there was a shouting match, but to repeat again, a European official said that the entire meeting was repugnant. And I have to say, repugnant in what sense? Repugnant because what Driscoll was setting out are the actual realities of the conflict, the realities that I have been discussing in program after program on this channel, that we have discussed on the Duran, that Robert Skidelsky has been trying to point out in Britain, in the House of Lords, that has been written about by Larry Johnson, Ian Proud, Ray McGovern, on Consortium News, in all sorts of places and venues, right across the independent media space, that you will hear in programs, in discussion places, though not ever in the mainstream, that these are the repugnant realities that Western governments, Western officials close their ears to? Or was it repugnant that the government of the United States, or an official of that government, the most powerful government in the West by far, the government that has to ultimately take responsibility, not just for European security, but for Western security, to the extent that there is a collective West. It is a collective West which is a geopolitical force only because the United States has made itself a part of it. Is it because it is the United States government that is telling them these truths? Is that what they find repugnant? My guess is that it is the second. I cannot believe that there is any European official who retains any connection to reality at this point that has any serious doubt any longer that Ukraine is losing the war. But that they should be told this by the United States, which led them into this enterprise, in which they joined enthusiastically, has shocked and stunned and infuriated them. Anyway, there have been meetings in Europe. The Europeans always come up with meetings, by the way. Keir Starmer apparently has tried to contact Trump. At least that's my understanding. Though for the moment, he hasn't been able to speak to Trump. And I get the sense that Trump is not so keen to speak to him. And we are now told that there's going to be a meeting in Geneva where Driscoll, Witkoff and Rubio are all going to be present, and where they're going to be confronting the Europeans. And the Europeans, as they always do, they say that they don't object to the idea of a peace effort, even though that is exactly what they really object to, but they want to change the document. And they object apparently to pretty much everything substantial in the document, which the Russians insist upon. So my guess is that they will again try to find some mechanism to leave open the possibility that Ukraine will one day join NATO. They want no restrictions on the size of the Ukrainian army or on the kind of weapons that it will retain. They want further commitments to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, and statements that borders cannot be changed by force. The Europeans have been involved in changing several borders by force. The Yugoslavs, the people of the former Yugoslavia, can tell you all about that. The people of Sudan can tell you all about that too. Just saying. But, well, Ukraine, of course, is the country that we must talk about instead. So that's the place where borders cannot be changed by force. Azerbaijan can change borders by force. So previously could Armenia, by the way. Cyprus, there's a division of Cyprus, which is still underway. But we don't talk about that. We have to focus instead on Ukraine and pretend that this is an absolute principle that cannot be compromised, even though we violate that principle regularly, if not all the time. Anyway, just to say, there's apparently got to be a statement about that. And of course, there also have to be provisions in the document relating to the frozen assets, the Russian frozen assets. The Europeans are very unhappy that the Americans want any part of them, a cut in them, which is true. They're furious that this proposal has come out because, of course, it goes completely against their project to basically appropriate the frozen assets and use them to float their own 140 billion euro loan to the Russians. Of course, that cannot happen if there is any possibility that some of these assets will go to the Americans and most of them will go back to the Russians. So that completely demolishes this whole idea of the loan. And Ursula and Merz are obsessed by setting up this loan, even though they've been categorically warned against doing so by no less a person than the chief executive of Euroclear. And also, they've received warnings to a similar effect from the Belgian, French and Italian governments. So they want all of that changed. They want all of that changed all the way back. And when they finished with all of these changes, what we will get is essentially a return to Kellogg's freezing of the conflict idea, which, going back to what Kellogg was saying, were it ever to happen, would indeed be a Minsk III. But the Russians have made it absolutely clear, categorically clear, that it cannot and will not happen. So it looks as if we're being set up in Geneva for a high noon. Now, again, it's far from obvious that the United States itself is united behind this. I suspect that Witkoff himself understands the realities. So, based on what he has said, does Driscoll. Rubio, I get the sense, likes to cut it both ways. He's perhaps not someone that can be relied upon completely. Starmer is apparently pressing Trump to extend the 27th of November deadline that the United States has given to Ukraine to agree to this plan or lose intelligence assistance. My own view is that the United States made a mistake by making that threat, because I don't believe that the United States, the Trump administration, will in the end ever really act on that threat. I was reading in the media in Britain that, of course, which may not make it an entirely reliable claim, but when the United States did cut off intelligence assistance from Ukraine back in March, the generals in the Pentagon were extremely angry, as I suspect was Kellogg at that time, and lobbied hard to get that ban lifted. And I suspect they will be doing exactly the same. And I don't think in the end that Trump wants a situation when, if the eventual collapse comes, he will be blamed for the fact because supposedly it was the denial of intelligence assistance that prevented the Ukrainians from holding back the Russians and enabling them thereby to win the war. So I suspect there's going to be, I suspect that this deadline, this ultimatum, is not going to be enforced. And I think it was a mistake to make it at all, because I don't think Trump will ever really enforce it. What Trump should have done, straightforwardly, is he should have told the Europeans, look, if you won't back this plan, if the Ukrainians won't back this plan, I'm not going to do anything anymore. I'm not going to waste time with diplomacy. I'm not going to supply any more weapons to Ukraine. You're welcome to buy them from us if you want to give to Ukraine, but you must come up with hard cash. I am going to walk away. What he should have done, in my opinion, the moment he became president. That, in my opinion, would be, even still, a more effective strategy than this ultimatum, which, as I said, I think Trump ultimately is going to back off from. But anyway, it's being billed as a high noon in Geneva. But ultimately, it all depends on Trump. Now, Trump made some statements yesterday, and it's difficult always with Trump's words to know how to interpret them exactly, because he said that the deal that's been offered is far from his final offer to the Ukrainians, and some people in Europe were seizing on that and were saying that that perhaps meant that the plan could be adjusted and improved, as they say, improved in Ukraine's favour. But of course, Trump also went on to say that if the Ukrainians won't accept the plan, then of course they can keep on fighting, and that the next plan that they get will be far less favourable than the one that they're currently being offered. So to me, I have to say this, it looked more like a threat than a concession to the Ukrainians. Basically telling the Ukrainians, look, it's the same as what Driscoll said to the Europeans. Look, this is the best we can do in this situation. It's impossible for us to improve on these proposals. The Russians are implacable. They hold all the cards. If you want to reject this plan, by all means, keep on fighting, but you're going to lose. And if before you lose, you come scampering back and to ask us for help, well, be prepared for the fact that the next proposal we will make will be a lot less favourable than the one you've just been given. So that, I think, is where we are at the moment. My own view is that Trump will backtrack. Lindsey Graham has now also been speaking out. He's tweeted messages which seem to me to be critical of this plan. I think the Senate in the United States remains still implacably supportive of Ukraine. I think that there's going to be great difficulty getting this thing to stick. And that's before a negotiation with the Russians even begins. And as I've said already, the plan will hardly survive in its present form once the Russians have worked on it. So I don't myself think there's any real prospect in this. I am in some respects surprised that the United States is even, that the Trump is still persisting with the diplomacy at all. I repeat what I've said already in previous programs, that what triggered the start of this whole process of discussion was the realization 3 weeks ago in the United States that the claims that the Ukrainians were holding their own were a fairy tale, that on the contrary, the front lines are crumbling, that the Russians are going to break through in Donbass very soon. There's a general understanding that if Donbass falls, the rest of Ukraine opens up for a Russian advance all the way to the Dnieper. And of course, if Ukraine loses all its territory east of the Dnieper, then economically it is in a catastrophic position. And if the Russians cross the Dnieper, then it really is a game over for Ukraine as a state. So I think that that was probably what triggered the decision to try to come to some kind of understanding with the Russians 3 weeks ago. But the forces that oppose this in Europe, in Washington, and of course in Kiev itself, remain as strong as ever and as resistant to reality as ever. In fact, they find it repugnant when reality is pointed out to them. So anyway, there we go. That's the situation with the diplomacy at the moment. In the meantime, the Ukrainians are also going to participate in the Geneva discussions. Notice that the Russians will not be there. So again, going back to what Eve Smith said all those months, maybe years ago, the Western powers are again negotiating with each other, not with the other side, with the Russians. The Russians are excluded from this meeting in Geneva, just to say. Anyway, there's going to be this meeting in Geneva, and the Ukrainians are also going to be there. And interestingly enough, the Ukrainian delegation is being led by Umerov and Yermak, precisely the two key officials who are the main target of the anti-corruption investigation in Ukraine. In fact, there are reports coming from Kiev that Umerov is going to be charged by NABU for corruption today. So Zelensky continues to have faith and confidence in these people. He apparently relies and depends upon them. I wonder whether Umerov this time will return to Ukraine if he is charged. He will presumably go to somewhere in Europe where he will try to continue, presumably, to be Secretary of Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council. Zelensky has told the investigators and the other plotters in Kiev that he's staying where he is and he's keeping his whole team with him. And the European Union, the European ambassadors, have told the plotters and NABU and SAPO that they do not support this investigation and that they want it all dropped. And as I've said, I have definitive information about this. So Zelensky still in control. Probably his position has stabilized a little over the last couple of days. But of course, this can only be effective for a few weeks. And certainly in Ukraine, his popularity now has completely shot to pieces. Now, in the meantime, I'm going to just mention something else, which is important and interesting if it is true, and I do believe that it is actually true. The information about it I have got from Russia, so I don't know how reliable it is. I personally believe it is very reliable, but I think it is important here to at least mention the provenance. Anyway, the information is that there has been a major meeting of central banks, but not of Western central banks, of non-Western central banks. And some countries have participated. China did not participate, so far as I know, and nor did Russia, not directly. The Russian and Chinese central banks were not directly involved, but central banks of other important global South countries, BRICS states and non-BRICS states, came together and met in secret. And there was a discussion about the situation with frozen assets and about the stability of the European system and about possible secondary sanctions. And I said that the Russians weren't involved, but they were aware of the meeting. And they did provide significant input into the information upon which this meeting worked. And the Russians apparently informed the participants of this meeting, the various central banks, that the figure that we are hearing about Russian frozen assets, mostly $300 billion, is wrong, that the actual figure is much bigger. Again, I'm not going to say how much bigger, but that the Russians have frozen Western assets in Russia that exceed the value of that amount, the amount of the Russian frozen assets. Of course, the assets that have been frozen in Russia are private, and the assets that of the Russian assets which have been frozen in the West are state assets. So we're not exactly comparing like with like, but the Russians have made it very clear that if their state assets are confiscated or misappropriated, they will confiscate Western assets in Europe. And since the confiscation of assets, state assets, is typically seen and historically always seen as an act of war, I think the Russians, were that to happen, would have some legal basis upon which to do it. I'm not saying it would be foolproof, I don't know, and I'm not going to enter into a discussion about it in this programme. I suspect that the confusion about the size of the Russian assets, the muddle is because it may be that we're talking about $300 billion of Russian central bank assets, but I suspect that there's been a significant further sums, hundreds of billions of dollars and euros more, of Russian state property owned by various state organizations, which have also been frozen by the West. And I suspect that it is these assets which have already been misappropriated and used by the Europeans to fund Ukraine, and which have by now, by the way, almost entirely disappeared. Anyway, never mind, let's get on to this. So the Russians explained this to the heads of these central banks. The central banks were apparently stunned and horrified. There was then a significant discussion about whether there is any real risk that the United States will go full out and launch an economic war against Russia, applying secondary sanctions against any country that trades with it. The consensus that was reached was that it would not happen because the disruption to the global economy, were it to happen, would be so enormous that it would have a massive and very significant effect on the Western economies first and foremost. But a decision was made, apparently, that if it did happen, then the global south and BRICS economies would remain calm, that they would see it through, that they would not break their relations with the Russians, though apparently the Russians made it absolutely clear to any country that if it preferred to maintain economic contacts with the West and end economic contacts with Russia, Russia would not hold that fact against them. But nonetheless, most of them decided that they would not do that. They said that they would remain calm and they would see the process through, and that they were confident that with the backing of each other and of BRICS, they would be able to see it through. Now, I want to stress, I don't have actual direct information about this meeting. I don't even know for a fact that the meeting took place. The source that has provided me with this information has been consistently reliable. The information comes from Russia. I believe it to be true. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say. Now, let's turn to the military situation where Putin is so confident, and I will go through this rapidly. Again, there's been a major Russian missile and drone strike across Ukraine. I don't have the full details. I will return to this in my next program. The Russians continue to advance in Zaporozhye region, and the attack on Gulyapolye is apparently now just over the horizon. The Russians have now completed the encirclement of the Ukrainian forces who are trapped in Mirnograd. Now, there is now information, and apparently it is secure information, that the Russian troops in northeastern Pokrovsk have advanced along the main road towards Rodinsk, and they have met up with other Russian troops who have been advancing south from Rodinsk. And that means that there is now a continuous circle of Russian troops surrounding the Ukrainian garrison that's still holding out in Mirnograd. So up to now, gaps in the circle have existed, though the Russians have always had fire control over these gaps. The gaps have now closed. The Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd face now a continuous ring of Russian troops that they can't get through. And by the way, we have the information, the confirmation that these two forces have united from the Ukrainians themselves. They provided it indirectly because they showed Ukrainian drones. They provided footage of Ukrainian drones attacking Russian positions in the central and northern areas of the road from Pokrovsk to Mirnograd, Pokrovsk to Rodinsk, and it is impossible for the Russian troops to be there without the closing of the circle. Rodinsk, the Russians seem to be in the process of clearing or pushing the Ukrainians out of northern Rodinsk again, and as I discussed 2 days ago, Radovka continues to say that the Ukrainians have withdrawn from Novopavlivka, and that what is happening there is that the Russians continue to conduct a mopping up operation. Now, the situation of the Ukrainians in Siversk is deteriorating rapidly. More important positions to the south of Seversk have fallen. Platonovka and Yampol, located to the west of Seversk, have also fallen. the Russians have apparently now cut the road to Siversk from Slavyansk. Well, they have clearly cut that road because Stiampol and Platonovka are located on this road. Anyway, that road has now been cut, so the Ukrainians cannot receive supplies through that road. The other road leading into Siversk from the southeast has apparently also been cut. The Russians now have control of that road too, which, if correct, would mean that the Ukrainian garrison in Siversk is now also in a kind of cauldron. It is a cauldron in terms of the supply roads. It is still possible for Ukrainian troops to try to escape Siversk across the fields. But the idea of doing so now, as in late autumn, in the very difficult weather conditions, with the Russians hunting them with drones and other weapons, well, I can't even begin to imagine what a spectacle of horror that would be. Siversk, as I've said many times, is a small place. There is a small river that bisects it, the Bakhmutka River. It might take some time for it to be cleared completely, but we are in the last days of the battle for Siversk. There's been no information from Kupiansk, which the Russians undoubtedly do now control, and the Russians clearly continue to tighten their positions around the Ukrainian troops caught out in the open east of Kupiansk, east of the Oskol River. There are still reports that the Russians are likely to announce the fall of Pokrovsk within the next couple of days or hours. Pokrovsk supposedly being cleared. I suppose it's a kind of race now. Which town falls first, Siversk or Pokrovsk? I would say, if I'm going to make a guess, that the Russian Defense Ministry will announce first the fall of Siversk. So the crisis for Ukraine is getting worse. And just to repeat again, all of these cauldrons that we've seen in Kupiansk, in Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, in Siversk before long, in Liman too, where there is now fighting inside the town. These are all, in my opinion, overtures, part of the first act of the really big cauldron which is coming, which is the encirclement of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, the great cauldron in Donbass, which many people, myself included, were talking about back in February and March 2022. It is just over the horizon. And if that cauldron is established within the next few months over the course of this winter, then regardless of what some people in the West still want to believe, the summer, it's difficult to imagine that if the war continues into the spring and summer of 2026, that what we will see then will be anything different from the final chapter in the fall, the complete fall of Ukraine. Some people in Washington can see it. In the American government can see it. The Europeans still consider it repugnant, apparently, when they are told this truth. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about this issue today. And this is where I'm afraid I must finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. And don't forget also to check out our new Substack site, Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.